Hello, welcome to South London Voices, a Tiger Spirit podcast that celebrates people in South London and beyond. I'm your host, multimedia author and South Londoner, Yangmei Ui. Today, I'm talking with novelist Anna Sobern Lane about her thriller, Unlawful Things. Now, before we get into the podcast itself, if you want to see photos of Anna and me during the podcast session and also some lovely snaps of her looking very authorly and pictures of her book Unlawful Things, and there are also links to some of the things that we're going to be talking about, you can go to the show notes page. And to do that, you need to go to southlondonvoices.co.uk and look for episode 6, episode SLV00. Unlawful Things with Anna Sobern Lane. So let's get stuck into the conversation with Anna Sobern Lane. Anna Sobern Lane, welcome to South London Voices.
Thank you very much.
Now, you are a long-term resident in South London. Actually, why don't you tell us what your connection is?
Well, I'm pretty much South London born and bred. My mother's family were all from South London. In fact, they ran a toy shop in Catford for about 100 years. And my mother wanted to move back to South London when I was quite young, so about 8. And we moved back to the Bromley area. And I grew up there, went to school, and then went off to university and came back and worked for my local newspaper when I first left university.
Gosh. So do you have any memories of, South London or, when you were a child? And it must have been amazing to have had family that owned a toy shop when you were a kid.
Yeah, it was a fantastic shop. It was called Swaddling Toys and Prams, and it was in Rushy Green in Catford. And I do remember going and visiting my grandpa when he ran the shop, and we were allowed to choose one really small toy. So we would be able to choose a farm animal, perhaps, or a little bouncy ball or something to take home. So that was all quite good.
Fantastic,
fun.
Yeah. Fantastic. And is the toy shop still there?
Sadly, no. About 15 years ago now, my uncle retired and they sold it.
Oh, that's a shame. And so you were drawn back to come to South London as a cub reporter.
That's right, yes.
Gosh, that must have been quite exciting.
It was. I was working on the News Shopper newspaper, which certainly at that time covered pretty much most of South East London. And the patch that I covered was Lewisham Borough and Greenwich Borough, which were quite lively places. So that stretched from sort of Brockley area right round to Abbey Wood, Thamesmead, taking in, all of the area in between. And it was quite a lively place to be reporting on. People used to say, working on a local paper, is it all sort of church fates and things? And I'd say, so far I've reported on a couple of murders, some race riots. There was some very hard news going on at the time, and it was an exciting and sometimes quite scary job.
Yes, and that would have been in the 1980s.
1990s, so early 1990s, early to mid-1990s. I worked about 5 years on that paper, covering, really everything from, like I said, very hard news stories. One of the earliest news stories that I remember reporting on as a young reporter was the murder of Stephen Lawrence, which was, obviously a huge story at the time, and we didn't have any idea then that it would still be, a pretty big story today, and a story that's really changed an enormous amount about Britain.
Yes, and it resonates still through the decades, and I think casts a shadow to us now today, even now.
Very much so, yes. And it was certainly something that was kind of in my mind a little in some of the things that I wrote about in the novel. Mm. Knowing that there had been this very dark event, knowing that there had been these people who'd, you know, committed this terrible crime really out of racial hatred and nothing else.
Yes, I think, you know, that's quite a meaty subject that we don't have the scope to cover in this podcast. But I think, you know, thank you for sharing that. And I think, you know, South London, and you're a novelist, and we're going to be talking about your novel, which has a dark background to it, Unlawful Things. But just before we get in into that, I think I'd just like to kind of hear a bit more about what it was like as a young woman in the 1990s reporting on crime and murder and so on in South London. Mm. You know, we hear about it in the news, we read it in books, we love murder mysteries and so on, but when we read it in a book, it's kind of at a distance.
Yeah.
But, you know, you were there on the ground. Could you share some of your experience about that?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that was probably most frightening, really, was this was in the aftermath of the Stephen Lawrence murder. There were a number of demonstrations, and these were demonstrations, by and large, organised by anti-racist groups. Some of them got pretty ugly and out of hand. At the time, the British National Party had its headquarters in Welling, and some of the marches went through Welling. There were clashes with far-right supporters. There were times when those marches became quite violent, and I was caught up in one where I actually ended up in hospital, having had something, I'm not entirely sure what, hit me over the back of the head, and I was knocked out and sort of scraped up off the tarmac and bundled into an ambulance with a lot of other people who'd been injured in that particular disturbance. And that's certainly an experience that I draw on fairly directly in Unlawful Things, you know, the experience of actually having been there whilst things are getting quite scary. And I think that's something that, yeah, it doesn't really come across when you think about reporters. You're not only, you're there on the ground now, you're going to be there next week and the week after. So, you know, if you're getting on the wrong side of people, they know where you are. They certainly know where you work. You have to be very mindful of your relationship with the community when you're working on a local newspaper.
So you're reporting, but you're also part of the community, and you need to have that courage and trust to get back on your feet and go back and do the reporting?
Yes, I guess that's true. I mean, I certainly did find that a really scary experience. I was back at work, you know, the next day and wrote it up for the paper. But it probably did stay with me a little bit. And that might have been one of the reasons why I kind of chose to move away from sort of frontline hard news reporting. I worked for a time as the arts and entertainments reporter, which was a fantastic job. And I got to see absolutely loads of great plays at the Greenwich Theatre, at the Churchill Theatre in Bromley, Dartford's Orchard Theatre. You know, I was going out once or twice every week to go and see things and review them for the paper, and that was, you know, that was a really good fun. I enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah, so quite a contrast, and of course tapping into your love of drama and stories.
Yes, very much so. Yeah,
which is quite a useful segue into your novel Unlawful Things. Could you tell us just what that's about initially?
Sure. So Unlawful Things is really about a quest for a missing play by the Elizabethan playwright Christopher Marlowe, who was a contemporary of Shakespeare. He came to a sticky end at the age of about 20, at the age of 29. He was murdered in what people say in a pub. It wasn't actually a pub, but it was in a boarding house in Deptford, which was literally just down the road from where I was living in Greenwich at the time. I was living sort of halfway between Greenwich and Deptford. And this little church where Marlowe is buried, they don't know exactly where he was buried, but there's a plaque on the wall and his death's registered in the parish register. So I suppose living in that part of London and knowing a little bit about that kind of fed into it. So the story is that walking tour guide, Helen Oddfellow, meets a historian who is looking for a missing play by Christopher Marlowe. And she gets intrigued by these trial documents that he's found that have a reference to a possible missing play. So she is a big fan of Christopher Marlowe. She's actually doing a PhD on his work. So she teams up with him in order to try and find this missing play. And it starts off as very much a sort of an academic quest, you know, a sort of puzzle. And they're following clues and trying to decipher codes and this sort of thing. But it becomes apparent fairly quickly that they're not the only people looking for this play, and that there's something about this play. This play gives away some secret that is very important to certain people, and that you know, some of the people who are also looking for the play will stop at nothing to get their hands on it.
Oh, so the plot thickens.
The plot thickens. People start to get hurt. Yes.
So that is quite an interesting and intriguing concept, that you start off with something that's you know, we all who are readers and playgoers, you think, oh yes, you know, missing play, how intriguing, quite an academic interest. Mm-hmm. It'd be quite nice to find out about it. Mm-hmm. But then suddenly it throws you deeper into some murky secrets.
That's right, yes. Yeah, and I had to think about, you know, what type of secret might Christopher Marlowe have known that could actually have an impact on today's world? And, you know, in a way, Marlowe's time was... It had a few echoes of today. It was a time of great religious disquiet, and it was just post-Reformation. So Elizabeth was on the throne, but there were still plenty of Catholics around who were unhappy about what had happened during the Reformation, and would very much like to have seen a Catholic monarch on the throne. There was a lot of instability politically because Elizabeth hadn't married, didn't have an heir. People were worried about what was going to happen next. If you look forward to a couple of decades after Elizabeth, James I came to the throne, and then we had the Gunpowder Plot, where people were literally trying to blow up the House of Parliament and the King and courtiers in order to change the religion of the country. So it was a time when there was an awful lot of intrigue going on.
Yes, yeah, so actually, if you think about it, there was an Elizabeth on the throne then, there's yes. an Elizabeth on the throne now. We've got religious turmoil in both periods, slightly different situations,
yes.
but also we've got terrorism, you know, blowing up Houses of Parliament. We can just think about what's been on the news in the last couple of years. And so it seems to me you're using an old story, a story set in the past, to perhaps explore things that are happening now.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, partly it's a cracking story. You know? I really wanted to dig into all of the exciting things that were going on at the time and look at whether there might be parallels today. But it's more, you know, it sets the scene for an adventure.
Yes, and I think that's what sometimes makes a really good read, because what you're at one level, you can read it as a page turner and you're kind of whizzing through it and it's a fantastic story. But subconsciously, you're also taking in, you know, deeper themes and you're learning something about the past. And that's why I think historical novels are great, because you're learning a bit of history without having to study the history book.
Sure.
And then also you're kind of prompted to think about bigger themes in terms of you know, different faiths, different beliefs, you know, how people there's some rioting in your book.
There is,
well,
yes,
that's drawn on from yes. your own experience.
That's right. Yeah.
And so now, Christopher Marlowe, so we've talked about your connection with South London. Christopher Marlowe died in a barroom fight or some kind, something like that, in Deptford in South London. Can you tell us more about his connection, his more general connection with South London?
Yes, he was born in Canterbury and then went to university at Cambridge. After that, he moved to London because he wanted to become a playwright. and he was writing for the theatre. He lived at different times in different parts of London, but one of the strongest connections was to the Rose Playhouse in South London, which is on Bankside. You can actually still see the foundations of it. It's underneath an office building, but you can now there's a trust that's kind of excavated and done some restoration, so you can actually go into this building. You walk in through this door and it looks like you're just walking into an ordinary office block, and you go through and suddenly you're in this archaeological site, which is the foundations of the Rose Playhouse. It's just along, really, really close to Shakespeare's Globe, the rebuilt Shakespeare's Globe, and it's pretty much spitting distance from the site of the original Globe Theatre, which I think is fascinating because you can see how close those two rival playhouses really were. So Marlowe would have was the chief playwright for a time for the Rose Playhouse, and his amazing plays, Dr. Faustus, Jew of Malta, The Massacre at Paris, were all put on there for the first time. And something that I found really interesting was I was doing more research into this, and I live now sort of halfway between Dulwich and Crystal Palace. I found out that the best records that we have of the Rose Playhouse are actually held in Dulwich College, which is an interesting little story in itself, because one of the most famous actors at the time, Edward Alleyne, who would have acted in these plays, he would have played Dr. Faustus for the first time. He retired to Dulwich, founded Dulwich College, amongst other things, and all of his papers and the papers of his father-in-law, Philip Henslow, who was actually the owner of the Rose Playhouse, they're all in the archive at Dulwich College. And they very kindly let me go along and sort of, you know, rifle through all these papers and look at all of these amazing records, you know, dating back to the 16th century, to find out more about the theatre at the time and you know, what it was like being an actor. I mean, this document has everything from, you know, what plays were put on which days, how much money they took, loads of records about the building of the theatre, you know, how much they paid for the nails that, that they built the theatre with. You know, it's an incredible resource.
Fascinating. Mm. And actually, I think Dulwich College is coming up to its 400th anniversary, founded in 1619. On my way here, I walked past it and I saw the sign. And it just gives me goosebumps, because at the Rose Playhouse they still put on plays.
They do.
And I went to see a play last year, they've got a little sort of platform where you can sit, and you're just above the archaeological ruins. It's absolutely freezing, there's no heating, but they have, the archaeological ruins are still covered in water. Mm. Because when they excavated it, if they drained the water, it would speed up the deterioration of the foundation. So they kept it underwater. Mm. And I think it's just so exciting and goosebumpy.
Yes.
That, you know, the playhouse where Christopher Marlowe's plays were put on, you can still go and see plays there.
Absolutely. And I did go and see a play there. And in fact, that makes its way into the novel as well. There is a scene where Helen goes and watches a play there and feels exactly that, you know, sort of imagines the ghost of Christopher Marlowe kind of floating in to sit next to her to watch the play. And as a result of watching the play, she then gets a kind of an insight and a sort of revelation about one of the things they've been working on. She suddenly realises something, and that kind of takes them on to the next stage of the plot.
So now I'm going to just pause us and give us a little bit of a flashback. Mm-hmm. Because what inspired you to write this play is also quite interesting. Can you tell us this novel? Can you tell us about that?
Sure. This was quite a long time ago. I am interested in literature, obviously, and London and history. And one year I just decided, really for fun, just for no particular reason, it would be interesting to retrace the walk that Chaucer's pilgrims did from Southwark to Canterbury. So I set off with my husband on one Easter weekend, and we started at Southwark Cathedral, or just around the corner from Southwark Cathedral, where the Tabard Inn used to stand, which is where Chaucer's pilgrims began their journey. And we walked, the first day we walked to all the way through South London, past the church where Marlowe is buried, which was sort of, I noticed and thought, oh, that's
can you remember the name of that church?
It's St Nicholas Church, St Nicholas Church on Deptford Green. And you can you know it when you see it, because it has gateposts with the most amazing ghoulish looking skull and crossbones on top of the gateposts, which is actually what made me go in and have a look and realise, you know, see the plaque about Marlowe and realise that that's where he was buried. So we walked all through there and then through Greenwich, up through Greenwich Park, across Blackheath, Shooter's Hill, all the way out through southeast London, heading east, and as far as Dartford on the first day. Stayed in Dartford because that's where my husband's mother lives, so we had a bed for the night. And then carried on over the next 2 days to Canterbury and arrived in Canterbury. And I'd been thinking about, we'd been telling each other stories along the way, you know, as Chaucer's pilgrims did, as travellers do, just to pass the time. And we were making up stories and jokes and all sorts of things. And when we arrived in Canterbury, we were right opposite the Marlowe Theatre. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And that was when I discovered that Marlowe was born in Canterbury and lived and grew up in Canterbury. And that kind of set me thinking again, well, okay, so if Marlowe grew up in Canterbury, you know, what secrets did he learn in Canterbury, perhaps, that that might have found their way into some kind of, you know, secret that that he used in the future? Was that why he was really murdered? All these sort of ideas. So, yeah, it kind of sparked the idea for what eventually became the novel on Unlawful Things.
Wow, fantastic. And so, as a novelist, you know, you can have, and all of us, you know, we wander along, say, oh, that would make a good story. Oh, that's so interesting. How do you then put it all together? How did you come up with the devious, ghoulish plot that, you know, would cover, is it 300, 400 pages of a novel?
Yeah, 420 pages. Oh, goodness knows. I wrote an awful lot of drafts. I think that's the main thing. I researched an enormous amount. I learned a huge amount about Christopher Marlowe. About all sorts of things that didn't make it into the novel. I read about four biographies of Charles Dickens thinking he was going to come into it and then eventually ditched him because it was too complicated. I learnt about theatre at the time. I learnt about a lot of different locations, and locations are really important to me, and, you know, getting a good sense of place. How did I bring it all together? I mean, it's really hard to kind of remember that other than by thinking I rewrote that so many times, because you write the first draft, it's not quite happening. You try again, you try something different. You keep trying something different. And eventually I got to the point where I thought, no, I think that's probably done now.
So then to come up with the sort of the mystery of what it is, that what the secret is, did that occur to you? Did you dig around? How did you, without giving any spoilers, are you able to say? Again, it's such an insight into how a writer's mind works.
There's something that, there's the MacGuffin. You've got to find your MacGuffin. What's the name of the filmmaker who says that? Oh gosh, it's gone. You need a sort of plot device. So what I was thinking was, okay, I want a secret that might have been known to a writer who lived both in Canterbury and London, that was important at the time, that might still be important today, that he might have learnt growing up in Canterbury. So I then started to think, okay, so what was going on in Canterbury when he was a boy? What had been happening in Canterbury in the previous, you know, within living memory of him being a boy in Canterbury? And the big thing really was the Reformation. So, you know, the effect that the Reformation had on Canterbury was quite extraordinary, as on towns across the country. But of course, Canterbury was the seat of the Church of England. So I thought, OK, it's got to be something about that. And I'm not going to go much further than this.
You have to read the book to find out.
Exactly.
Fantastic. Yeah. So I think that's really interesting, because I think I'm kind of putting it in my head,
you know, what would be an equivalent situation here? It would be like a filmmaker or a TV writer or a playwright in modern times discovering a secret, maybe from, you know, the Cold War or from the Second World War, or something that has, you know, global or international consequences, if it was revealed, and they wrote a play about it, and then people had wanted to stop them.
Yes, so it'd be harder today. They'd just put it up on YouTube or something.
Yes, but I mean, those days it was, you know, we didn't have those things, and it was the physical manuscript that went missing, and so. Ooh, very intriguing.
Yeah. And then a lot of it was about looking for the right locations. So I was then thinking, I need somewhere between London and Canterbury. I want it to be a kind of a stately home or something like that would have been around at the time as well, you know, that was dates from Elizabethan time. So I started thinking about, you know, what places might fit that. And then I went and visited a place called Cobham Hall, which is actually a school now, but at the back in the 16th century, it was an Elizabethan stately home, manor house. And did some research on that and found the most amazing things happened during the history of that place, and incorporated as much as I possibly could into the novel, whilst at the same time completely making free with history and inserting my own facts where necessary.
So what you've done for the reader is actually, we don't have to go off and do all this research. You've done it for us, and it's all wrapped up in this page-turning thriller that's going to whiz along and keep us intrigued. Now, Unlawful Things is coming out when?
It's the 25th of October.
And if people want to find out more about it?
At the moment, because it's not published yet, it will be published on Amazon, or through Amazon rather. But if you want to know more about it at the moment, best place to look is my website, which is www.annasaburnlane.com.
And you have a special gift for people who come to your website. What's that?
Yes, well, if you sign up to my newsletter, then you get a... first of all, you can see... you can read a couple of the first couple of chapters of the book. So, you know, try before you buy. See if you're intrigued by the opening of the novel. But I also asked an artist friend to draw up a little map, which is of Bankside in South London. And it shows some of the key historical locations in Bankside, which are mentioned in the novel. As I think I mentioned at the beginning, my hero, Helen, is a walking tour guide. And towards the beginning of the novel, she actually does, you know, we see her giving a guided tour, which is where she meets this historian. So I've kind of recreated that little tour. So you could download this map, print it off, take yourself up to London Bridge and do your self-guided tour as Helen would have done it. You know, and it's got all of the information about the place that she takes them.
Wow, that is fantastic. And what a wonderful gift to your readers. Anna Saban Lane, thank you very much for sharing your story and for telling us about your book. I will have links and also photos to some of the things that Anna and I have been talking about on the show page. Details coming up very soon.
Our South London voice today was Anna Saburn Lane, and her website again, to go and check out all her news and events and also to get that freebie map, is annasaburnlane.com. And you can also find her on Twitter as @BloomsburyBlue. To find photos and links to some of the things we talked about today, go to southlondonvoices.co.uk and search for episode 6, episode SLV006, Unlawful Things with Anna Saban Lane. Or you can use the bit.ly short link, and here's the link now, bit.ly/SLV-unlawful-things. The South London Voices podcast is produced by tigerspirit.co.uk. I'm Yang Mei Ui, and I'm on Twitter and Instagram as @TigerspiritUK. You can also follow South London Voices on Twitter, and the Twitter handle for South London Voices is @SouthLondonVox, that's VOX, at South London VOX. And we're also on Facebook. You can go to facebook.com/South London Voices. Thanks for listening and see you next time.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.